Hello, just to let you know that this episode contains strong language.
Welcome. We are gathered here today in this online sonic space to hopefully discover the reason why. I'm Seamus Carey. Let's begin. At the time of recording, we still await the results of the 2021 UK National Census, so I'll have to refer to data from the previous census in 2011. It was found then that the dominant form of religion within Cornwall was unsurprisingly Christianity. However, there'd been a 14% decrease in the past 10 years amongst Cornish Christians. The census also found that Islam had seen a 27% increase within that time, as well as Buddhism, 84%, and Hinduism, 113%. Cornwall has long been a home of hard-working, God-fearing, well-intending Christians. But as these results show, things are beginning to change. All across the landscape, Methodist chapels are being abandoned, sold off and repurposed. Some people turn them into homes, others into workshops. And some still use them for prayer, but not perhaps in the way you might expect. How is Cornwall's attitude towards different faiths shifting? And what else is going on here, which people don't talk about as much? Let's find out. In The Reason Why.
Episode 9, Holding Steadfast.
Okay, so I'm in my car, as always, it seems, but I am about to get out as I'm parked outside the Quenchwell Memorial Chapel near Carnan Downs, which is, to be honest, typical of what you see all over Cornwall. Often they're fairly small, but it does make you think about how basically everyone in those days went to chapel, because there's so many everywhere. However, this one ended up being left empty for 11 years, apparently. Often, the upkeep is just too much for the small, if not dwindling, congregations. It was then bought by some new owners in 2008, who kept the outside pretty much the same, but the inside has been completely transformed. I'm about to go meet them, as this is now the Cornwall Islamic Centre, and it's time for Friday prayer.
Some people might be shocked to hear that this is the only public place of worship for Muslims in the whole of Cornwall. You might be even more shocked to hear that this isn't even really a proper mosque. Here's Tipu, who explained to me the reason why.
You call this a mosque, but really a mosque is a place where people have to pray five times a day. And you also have children's classes. But our demographic doesn't. This part is dedicated purely for our prayer. This room, if you like. The rest of it, as you can see, we've had birthdays here. We've had smaller wedding parties here. So it's a place where we can instantly say, right, we know where to go.
Yeah, sure.
Where before we had to book in and then we might not have had it.
Tipu described the long journey he and his fellow trust members went on to secure their own space. It wasn't easy.
I came down from London with a group of friends in Penzance in back in 1985. Obviously, there was nothing here, and the nearest place we could find at that time was in Exeter, which, in fact, it took me a day trip to find the place. And that's how we got it. Then eventually, by 1993, there were other restaurants and takeaways opening in Cornwall. Mm-hmm. We discovered there were doctors in the hospital. We applied to the Truro Boys Club for Friday prayers. And obviously we got turned down, and that became that came into the papers.
Yeah.
And when that came into the papers, and people started looking for who it was, so it was me they were looking for.
Right, yeah,
and that's
yeah.
how we found each other.
So we let any news is good news.
Yeah. Yeah.
Following that incident, the Trust then spent nearly 15 years bouncing from one venue to another. They used a village hall or Truro College, and all this time they kept searching for a permanent property to call their own. But then, of course, 9/11 happened. Soon, the Muslim world became a media focus, and a negative one at best. Every potential property that the Trust looked into became a newsworthy event, resulting in the predictable response of rejected. Finally, in 2008, the Trust signed the deeds for Quenchwell Chapel. But sadly, that wasn't the end of their troubles. Tipu didn't want to talk about this too much, which is fair enough. But via old news stories, I discovered that the centre has been the target of numerous cases of racial abuse and vandalism. The worst being just before the building opened, when a pig's head was nailed to the front door. Slogans were spray-painted on the walls, one saying, "Free Cornwall." When I raised this topic, I was surprised by how unsurprised Tipu was.
I've grown up in this country from the age of 9. I've seen a lot of it. I grew up in Third Avenue and Ladbroke Grove. So I know what prejudice looks like.
Yeah.
And to me, it's become a part of, you take it two way. You either take it inside and you become depressed, or you become take it like water on duck's back.
On the whole, Tipu seemed very positive about how the Islamic Centre had fitted in within the local community.
I mean, one memory comes to mind. There was this wonderful, about 80-year-old lady. She was walking past. She said when she was a little girl, they used to come in this place. And it was wonderful. I invited her, and we've had several local invitation. I hope she has come in one of those. I said, once it's done, please come in and see that, we are still practicing the same God, although you have your way of praying and we have our way of praying.
What do you think that old lady thought of you guys being here?
She was more happy that this place was being reused again, because it was from her that I learned that this place has been closed for 11 years. Mm-hmm. She said, it's been shut for so long. Those who have embraced us, those who have come here, there are people who live locally, and they're very welcoming and they're very warm.
On this note, there was one event in particular in 2019 which really brought the communities together. Alas, due to tragic circumstances. On the 15th of March, a 28-year-old white man entered two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, during Friday prayers. He opened fire and killed 51 people, as well as injuring 40 others. Shockwaves were sent around the world as charity fundraisers, vigils and memorials took place, all in response to this white supremacist attack. The following week, people from different walks of life and religions gathered at the Cornwall Islamic Centre to show their solidarity for the Muslims living in Cornwall. A 2-minute silence was held to remember those who had died. Food was shared, and several people spoke, including a former Australian rugby player, as well as Mohammed Abbasara, a lecturer at Tremo campus in Penryn. He said, "Muslims, Christians, Jews and atheists are all part of one community which rejects division, extremism, racism and violence." I asked Tipu about this momentous sounding day.
That was unbelievable, the amount of people. We were so overwhelmed. Mm. I mean, obviously, we had the MPs and everybody here, and the amount of people that were here, it was literally like a sardine type of pack, right the way from upstairs, downstairs, back room, and it was incredible.
Do you feel like there was a shift after that moment?
I think it's humanity, isn't it? It's humanity woke up in people, because although it was people who got shot in the mosque, If you take the word mosque away, it's humans. A human killing a human.
Soon, it was time for prayer. Tipu invited me to join. I was very aware that there I was, a 27-year-old white man, walking into Friday prayer. I sat at the back, respectfully, watching the men get ready. And then, something rather brilliant happened.
You could ask this young man quite a few questions.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure.
Hey, man.
I'm John.
Hey, John.
I looked around to see a short, white man, about my age, bounding across the room towards me. He had a long red beard, squashed down by his face mask, as well as a white takir upon his head. When he opened his mouth, I heard a beautiful Cornish accent.
Are you from Cornwall, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, great.
Regiment.
Okay. And so when did you...
9 years.
Okay. You've been a Muslim for 9 years?
Yeah.
And
I should point out here that this man has an extremely Cornish name. John Tonkin. We stepped out into the back room to continue our chat.
You're the first Cornish white man who's also a Muslim that I've met in my life.
Oh,
and I guess I'm just intrigued by your journey. How did your family and friends take it?
Mum was absolutely fine with it. You know, she actually drove me here and all like that, and she waited. Now, grandparents, no. They didn't like it at all. They put up with it, but they didn't like it. Mm. My uncle, absolutely not. But
and where's that coming from? What do you think their issues with it?
Most of the trouble is the media, because it's always about... you know, terrorism and all like that. Because, like, you know, I mean, I've had plenty of arguments, you know, normal conversations with my grandparents and other people that I always say, I can tell if it's a so-called terrorist attack or a shooter just by the article in the very first thing. Because why? Because if the BBC puts down terrorist attack, more than likely it's a so-called Muslim. Mm-hmm. If they put down shooter, it means it's a white man.
Unsurprisingly, John has found these attitudes on the streets of Redruth too.
I had an old lady come up to me saying, "Why is Islam about terrorism?" I said, "It's not." And she said, "Well, it's everything is terrorism in the world today because of Islam." I said, "So if we go with the 20s to the 40s, the Jews were the problem. When after the war, communists were the problem. Once the Russian Empire fell, the Soviet Union, they had to find someone. Who was there? The Muslims. Why? Because of the Middle East."
I was interested in John's take on history. But then, he made a surprisingly honest confession.
Were you aware of this before you became a Muslim?
No.
You sort of self-educated?
I was a fascist before I was a Muslim. Meaning, I actually hated Muslims. Mm. I was exactly like people, but I was more...
Because you believed the propaganda.
Exactly. Mm. I was... hardcore. I wasn't one of these people up just dislike them. No, I hated Muslims. I believed that they were taking over our country, they were imposing their way of life, they were all terrorists, all this. You know, absolute hardcore. It's not until gradually, because I was fascist between 14 and 17, I would say. Young age.
And when you say fascist, do you feel like you actually went out of your way to do fascist acts, or was it just the way?
No, I had it. I had the belief.
Yeah.
It was time to let John continue with his worship. But before I left, he gifted me some pamphlets and a copy of the Quran. I was very touched. I stepped out of Quenchwell Chapel with a strange sense of hopefulness. I think upon arrival, I expected to find an isolated group detached from the Cornish status quo. But instead, I met friendly, upbeat Muslim men who clearly felt like they were part of a community. A few weeks went by, but I couldn't stop thinking about the experience and how John Tonkin, a Cornish Muslim man, had described how our perception of unknown things is so shaped by the media. In episode 2 and 3, we looked at the issue of reality versus fantasy and how Cornwall is often portrayed on TV. There was something that happened here during 2021 which took this subject to another level. It was globally recognised as a significant moment and involved many politicians and heads of state. Some said it was just what the world needed right now. Others thought it was a very expensive publicity stunt. On the 23rd of January, Boris Johnson announced that the UK would host the G7 summit that year in Carbis Bay, Cornwall.
We start at the G7 summit in the English county of Cornwall.
The summit is taking place in the resort of Carbis Bay, located in the southwest of England, in Cornwall in the United Kingdom.
Beautiful day for the leaders here and a beautiful view for them to look out onto.
The Prime Minister taking a morning dip and now walking along the beach.
Thousands of delegates, journalists and police are here.
I could tell you about the G7, about the hype, and the exciting rumours that spread around Cornwall, like Joe Biden going into the Londis in Lanna, or how somebody's mate was offered £2,000 to have a sniper on their roof for a week. I could tell you about the amazing disruption it caused to the general public and local infrastructure. I could tell you about the people who came, about what they said, and the promises that were made. However, I don't think I need to. It was probably one of the most well-reported events of the year, and you can easily look it up for yourself. Although there was one element I did find interesting. The irony. Leaders of some of the richest countries in the world came to stay just outside St Ives, a town which has been gentrified from a working place into a bougie, overpriced replica of its former self, where holiday homes are rife, but 36% of children live below the poverty line. There was one image that said it all. Outside the Triangle Methodist Chapel on the road into St Ives was a small, modest sign welcoming the G7 leaders. It said, "St Ives Food Bank welcomes you. Please remember when discussing economic recovery from COVID-19, food poverty has quadrupled even in this area." Who knows whether this message was seen from the limousines as they undoubtedly passed by. But this photo by Greg Martin summed it all up. In fact, I don't want to tell you about the absurdity of the G7 at all. I want to tell you what it's really like for thousands of people living in Cornwall right now. It's fucking bleak. Dear world leaders, welcome to Cornwall. Between April and September 2021, 30 food banks in Trussell Trust's network distributed 5,100 emergency food parcels a day to people in crisis. The number of people claiming unemployment benefits has more than doubled since the coronavirus pandemic began. The average house costs 8 times the average salary in Cornwall. The Cornwall and Isles of Scilly suicide rate is amongst the highest in the UK. Did any of this get mentioned during the photo shoots on the beach? Nah, doubt it.
A lady was crying in the schoolyard, and she took her to her office. She found out that because of waiting for universal credit, the daughter had only been having beans on toast and the mum hadn't eaten for 3 days. And the head rang me up, and because we are an emergency service, that lady had food within the hour. That gives me the satisfaction that I helped somebody today.
This is Don Gardner. He's an absolute legend. Camborne, born and bred, he spent most of his life working for Holman Brothers Limited, who manufactured mining equipment. At their peak, they employed nearly all the men from the town.
We were like an extended family to the directors.
Mm-hmm.
When the Holmans themselves died out and the company was owned and run by people outside that moved into the area, all they were after was the profit. They were interested in the people. And I think that's where the tide turned.
When the company closed in 1968, it left an irreplaceable void.
There's no big payers in the area. That's the problem. When you had large companies paying good wages, there was always that competition that you could move. But now there's nothing. Mm. You know, I don't think there's a company around here that employs much more than 150 people.
After retiring, Don volunteered for the Transformation CPR Food Bank, something that would become a huge part of his life.
The first month, we provided 6 people with food. So that would have been 6 times 80 of us, 18 meals.
11 years later, and...
in February, we provided 14,863 meals.
In November 2020, something wonderful happened. Don was featured in the BBC Two programme Cornwall with Simon Reeves. It showed the harsh reality of poverty in Camborne and Redruth and the sheer brilliance of Don and his team's efforts. In fact, during the interview, Don was brought to tears as Simon Reeves thanked him for his bravery. They were meeting just one day before the funeral of Don's beloved wife, Jen. Within hours of the programme being aired, donations began to flood in. By the end of the week, Transformation CPR had received £160,000, enough to last them 2 years. Don was astounded by this reaction.
Well, yes, I mean, I've got people now that are still sending me money.
Really? And yeah. Do people write to you? Do you have any...
Yeah.
Do you know who they are?
Oh, a lot of them, yeah. A lot of people will write letters. They said that the Simon Reed programme, they were shocked. And several have sent me their holiday money, and they couldn't believe how poor inner Cornwall is.
Don has now retired from CPR, knowing it's financially safe for the time being. Yet I doubt they'll be able to keep him away for long. I always knew these problems existed in places like Camborne and Redruth, but it turns out that even in my hometown of Falmouth, there's a growing demand for free, hot food. I've got some brilliant mates, who are mostly my age, who started doing vegetarian community feasts in a Falmouth sports hall just before COVID. But then, in response to the pandemic, they changed their mission.
It was just kind of like panic. Shit, we can't do feasts. Shall we do something else? We'll just cook and deliver things. Because it was more for people who were in isolation at the time, I think.
This is Charlotte, co-founder of the Falmouth Food Co-op.
It was like an emergency service vibe of like, we just need to do something, what can we do? We know that there's people who need support.
And that is one of my oldest best friends, Rosa, another food co-op founder.
How long did it take to build momentum? Was it a fairly quick take-up?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was quick. We had like a hotline that people could ring up, and I was on the phone all the time at one point.
Yeah.
So, essentially, it's a volunteer-run, free, vegetarian meals and wheels service funded by a crowdfunder, Cornwall Council, and various other pots of money.
So at the peak, the first lockdown, we were doing about 630 meals a week. And now, where we're easing out of third lockdown,
yeah,
we're doing 300 meals a week and cooking once a week.
It's open to anyone, with no questions asked.
Have you ever questioned people's need for it? Would you even go there?
Quite a lot of people say that to us, but I think that in reality, there aren't many people who would ask for food unless they really needed it.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever really been a worry.
No.
And like the fact that anybody feels the need to have support, it's valid, you know? It's not up to us to decide who gets in, who doesn't.
I think what I find inspiring about the Falmer Food Co-op is that it's run by young, local people who really care for their community. Yet, it's also quite saddening that in 2021, people have to phone a hotline for a meal. We can afford an estimated £70 million for policing the G7 summit, but there are folks going about the basic necessities of life just down the road. I wondered if Charlotte and Rosa had had any response from those who they'd helped.
Have you met people or had any moments of thanks from people?
I think more the delivery people have had side of things. Mm.
There's definitely been like quite emotional phone calls, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Where it's like someone in that moment has chose to call that hotline for a reason that isn't related to food or something.
And it makes you realise that
they
haven't got people sometimes to like lean on or.
Mm.
There's one more thing we need to talk about in this episode. As I mentioned before, I run a male voice choir called Men Are Singing. Through this, I made lots of new friends, and one of them was this guy.
My name is Phil Collier, and I am a psychological well-being practitioner.
Originally, I started the choir as a musical experiment, but I rapidly discovered that it went much deeper than that. Phil helped me understand the mental health benefits of communal singing. He also told me about the problem with suicide in Cornwall, particularly amongst men.
It's above the national average, and it has been above the national average for over 15 years now. There's a myriad of reasons, and some are direct causes, and some you've got to think around the corner a little bit. I guess the main reason is that a lot of the industries have gone. Working mines, farming or fishing, are now self-employed. Interestingly, it's the building trades like plasterers finishing off houses that have the highest correlation of suicide risk.
I wondered why these jobs in particular.
So the unique factors with those professions is that you're finishing off a job, you're finishing off a project, so you don't know when the money's next coming in. Communities that were thriving haven't been able to regenerate because the younger people haven't been able to afford housing, haven't been able to live in places where they grew up. And so that in itself isolates people. Many of the services in the local community have essentially shut down, so there's no sense of a centre to a village, for example. A lot of older adults are living alone. The families haven't been able to live with them and have moved out of the county. So there's a lot of isolation with older adults.
Phil had a fascinating overview of the wider societal issues.
The stark fact about suicide is it's preventable. And we live in a society, especially in Cornwall, where it's not talked about as much as it should be talked about. It's hidden away as much as possible. And I guarantee that if somebody has known someone who has ended their life, one of the things that we collectively think is, I wish they talked to me. I wish they talked to somebody. And I think this is what we need to be doing. I want suicide prevention and talking about suicide being part of the common language, the everyday language that we all use. Because through connectivity, we can save lives. It's the thing that stops people from ending their life. Mm. That sense that they belong. That sense they belong to friends and family and have a wider family.
I asked Phil what advice he'd give if someone was experiencing suicidal thoughts.
Start talking. ideally start talking without any alcohol on board or dope or anything like that, but talk. For people who recognize that somebody's talking, be responsive. Listen.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode and need someone to talk to, you can call Samaritans for free now on 116 123 or visit www.samaritans.org to find your nearest branch. We're nearing the end of my sonic exploration of Cornwall, its highs and its lows. But I still had some unanswered questions. Having looked at many of the historical and contemporary social issues here, I began to wonder, how could I use everything I've learnt along the way to forge my own identity, which is honest, celebratory and inclusive? Can I and should I remain here? And what is the reason why? Find out next time on The Reason Why.
The Reason Why was written, presented and produced by Seamus Carey. The music was by him too. This episode featured music by Jim Carey. Additional production on the theme tune was by Mr. BJ Jackson. Graphic design by Phyllida Blumel. Photography by Steve Tanner. Special thanks to all our contributors, as well as the Holman Climax Male Voice Choir for the sampling of their 1974 album, The Reason Why. The associate producer was Charlie Bunker. The executive producer was Paul Dodgson. This was an Impossible Producing and Seamus Carey production funded by Arts Council England.